Why can't Western people stand up for themselves anymore? You can go into France and you can burn down Notre Dame if you want, and nobody will do a thing about it. You could walk into a church and you could make fun of Jesus, you could call him whatever you want. No one's going to do anything. You could go into college and you could write thesis after thesis about why white European people, why Western people are demons, are ugly, are gargoyles, are aliens. You can say whatever you want about these people, and they're not going to do anything. And then if you were to walk down the street and find some of these Western European people, whether it's in America or whether it's in Europe and maybe even the rest of the world, and you're to talk to these people and say to them, hey, what do you think of yourself? They'll start to shrivel. They'll shrivel up. They'll react. They'll be like, me? Oh, I'm awful. I'm a terrible demon. Inside of me is a horrible, wretched soul. Inside of me is the same monstrous soul that enslaved the whole earth. Inside of me is the same savage, nasty instincts that created capitalism so that I could exploit nature and exploit all people of the world. I am a demon upon this earth, and I must crush this soul within myself to make sure that that monster does not return. I am the source of evil, and my ability to suppress my soul, to crush my instincts, to crush what I am, that's what makes me good. That's what gives me a right to exist in this world. And you might say to this Western person you've stopped on the street, you might say, bro, I was just going to ask for directions. I was just looking for a local coffee shop. What the hell is wrong with you? You've got some serious mental issues. I think you need to go see a therapist. I think you need to go see somebody who's going to analyze your psychology, because you sound a bit twisted. You sound a little bit kind of off there, bro. Sounds like there's something going on inside the whole, you know, mind of yours that you need to take care of, because that's not a normal response to just getting tipped on the shoulder. And lucky for us, there is the perfect psychologist for this situation. You, if you ever meet a European person, a Western person, you tip them on the shoulder and they have this bizarre reaction where they start going into this orgy of self-hate, this confused orgy of how much they are disgusted with themselves. You can just call up Dr. Friedrich Nietzsche and you can send them over to do a session with Nietzsche, who will psychoanalyze these Europeans and explain to them why they have this toxic way of seeing themselves. Now, I actually found Friedrich Nietzsche very useful to psychoanalyze me as a European person, but not in the way that you would expect. Because you see, I am Irish, so I'm a member of one of the slave races of Europe, the slave races of the world. In fact, most European people are conquering races. They are people who took over the world, who asserted themselves upon reality, and now they're feeling an awful lot of guilt for what they did in the past. Us Irish were an awful lot like all the other minorities, the Africans, the Indians. We were victims of this aggressive instinct, for me, by the English particularly. And so we don't suffer from that same guilt. We have a different emotional relationship. But this perspective of coming from a slave people and understanding the consequences and problems that come with you being a slave actually really helped me understand the problem with this self-hate that is so prominent in the conquering races, in the masters such as the English, the Germans, the Americans, the French, the Spanish, and the Italians, the people who took over the world. And this is because the concept that Nietzsche uses to explain to us the psychology at the root of this European self-hate, this guilt psychosis that infects modern Western people, is based on what we call the dialectic of the masters and the slaves. Now, I know dialectics, pretty big word, that's a big lump of jargon, so untwist your knickers, and we'll break it down and make it very clear about what this means, because this is important. Now, this dialectic comes from another German incel. There's so many of them. There's millions of these German incels, these philosophy cells from the 19th century. And this German incel is Hegel. And he is pointing out something quite intuitive when you think about it, that throughout all of history, there's always generally two forces. There is the conquering people who create giant political orders, and then there is the conquered people who are enslaved by these political orders. A good example of this would be Rome and pretty much everybody else in Europe at the time. And the relationship between these two forces is incredibly important, because all of these people, all of the people involved in this story, come to understand themselves based on their conflict. The master, the Romans, would understand themselves as superior, or they understand what it means to be Roman or their virtues on account of the trials and tribulations they go through to conquer the Gauls, or the failure to conquer the Germans, or they're conquering the Carthaginians. If you read through Roman history, it's always these great wars that are the defining moments in this story of the Romans. And then, of course, the Germans, or the Gauls, or the British, or the people from Morocco, or the Jews, they would all understand themselves in relationship to this conquering force, this Roman Empire, these Roman masters. To put in a simple analogy, this is like a marriage. A man comes to understand what it means to be a man, to be manly, to fill his role as male, by observing how he is different than his wife. He sees the feminine graces that she has, the magical intuition she has, the ability for her to read the stars, the capacity for her to understand the subtleties of beauty, the elegance and grace that comes with femininity, her ability to stimulate prophecy, her ability to create children. He sees all these things. And in this dialectic relationship with this woman, he comes to understand what he is. Their self-consciousness comes up from the conflict with the other. And then the woman experiences the same thing. She sees the man's naturally superior physical strength, his emotional stoicism, his assertiveness, his ambition, his higher testosterone, his disagreeableness, his ruthlessness in establishing boundaries, his high standards. She sees all these things and she understands him as different. She understands what it means to be a woman in relationship, in dialectic with the man. And so the more I got to understand the Irish story, the more I begin to see this dialectic. I, as an Irishman, am in a conversation, in a relationship with the English, whether I like it or not. And the clear understanding of this is how being conquered by a master race has affected my psychology as a slave race, even if it happened in the past. Because I inherit an awful lot of things that are derivative consequences of this historical grievance. I'm sure you've heard that before. People talk about it in universities all the time. The historical trauma of being conquered. And it is a real thing. To put it simply, I'm a bit salty about these goddamn Brits hopping on their ships and coming over and taking my land. But think about why I'm salty. Think about the scars that this experience has put inside of me. Think about what my ancestors went through. 400 years ago, my ancestors had to go through horrific trauma at the hands of these aggressors and these invaders. They would have stolen food off us. They would have limited our potential for upward mobility in our society and forced us to work farming and labor jobs. They would have come down in the village, these soldiers, and they would have found the best looking girl, the apple of the eye to one of my male ancestors who was looking at her since they were both teenagers together. And then this British soldier comes in and probably takes her against her will, or maybe not against her will, who knows, and breeds her. And there's nothing I can do about it because they have the guns and I've been cooked to be some stupid peasant laborer. And then they breed with her. And then all of a sudden now, this pristine apple of my eye is tainted and taken by someone else. I have been humiliated. All of these opportunities are taken from me. I cannot fight. Their weapons are taken out of my hands. I am forced to work and pay taxes and pay all sorts of things to these lords who own all the land. Maybe I am starved like in things like the famine. And of course, as I said, my breeding opportunities, my ability to literally live and create families is restricted. The good-looking girls are stolen from me. This is a humiliating experience. This is traumatic exploitation. It is not nice to be a slave. It sucks to lose. Losing in a UFC fight is okay. You can just pick yourself up. You're going to get paid loads of money. Losing in war in world history means such intense things. You could have been castrated. You could have been just outright killed because they saw no need for all the males. You could have been forced to work. And as we said, your girls could have been stolen. This is not good. This is a complete destruction of yourself down to your very core. And of course, on top of this, the experience my ancestors would have had is they would have to look at these lords in their castles with their fancy wagons, with their Bugatti wagons driving around flexing on me, flexing on the broke Irish boys. They would have been able to ride in their horses, me paying their taxes. Well, they don't work. They spend all their day having sex, making all this silly music, writing books and all this cope, wearing fancy outfits. While I labor, while I'm underneath their foot. This creates inside of me a sizzling, boiling hate a resentment. I see these people and I despise them. I want to hurt them. Luckily, they have taken all my weapons, so I have no force. I have no power. They come in and do marches around my towns to make sure that we're not organizing as a military. I'm completely spiritually castrated. I just have to roll over and take whatever they wish. As Thucydides said, the weak suffer what they must, the strong do as they wish. Now, these experiences have been seared into my collective and racial memory. Me being Irish, I've inherited this in many different ways. One, through all the stories that I'm told about these experiences. We always get told about the terrible experience of the famine, where the British took our food and essentially instantiated forced starvation, which is essentially destroying our people, causing a great amount of trauma and pain and suffering and difficulty. And also the genetics. You know, I am Irish for thousands of years hence, and those people exist in me still. I'm essentially the exact same as them. I come from them. Their trauma was, you know, installed epigenetically into their genetic code. Their DNA was rearranged, and the stresses that happened to them was installed inside of them. We actually know this with modern science that, you know, if you feed a kid a horrible diet, a very stressed-filled diet or life, that can manifest two or three generations down the line. There are generational consequences to things like stress and struggle. So trauma has that effect on people. So my ancestors going through these things has a literal effect on how I look, the capacity for me to succeed, various things about my life. It shows up in me. I carry it in my body. My body remembers absolutely. And God knows how deep this can go in the old spiritual esoteric sense. How do we know that those memories can't be unlocked? How do we know that I don't have this, you know, collective dreaming mind that has been connected to the Irish people where we store all that spiritual energy? This is where we're getting into Carl Jung here, where we're talking about the collective unconscious, which is definitely present, definitely a part of this, you know? I am Irish in my soul, and my soul is filled up with this traumatic experience of being enslaved. It's very much like Judaism. You read through the story of Torah, the Bible, you read through these early stories of Judaism, and it's all these discussions about the traumatic experiences that the Jews went through as slaves. They went through a very similar thing. They're wandering around in Egypt being like, oh, they enslaved us again. And then they escape and they run and they conquer the promised land. And then, oh no, the Babylon, now the Assyrians, now the Babylonians, they're just getting enslaved the whole time. And it's getting installed inside of them, this pain, this trauma. And this has to have an effect on us. Now, how this manifests is what Nietzsche would call a slave morality. Again, jargon, untwist your knickers, and I'll explain that in a simpler way. The perspective of the slave. The story that me and my ancestors would tell ourselves about our reality was built on our perspective. And this is an important thing to become very aware of, because my perspective, my story, is going to have a very specific good and evil, a very specific tone. I'm going to tell a sort of Lord of the Rings story. Us Irish, we're handsome, little, nice, cool, sound hobbits. We're good lads, you know. We're not out there to do anything crazy like take over the world. We're just out there to chill, drink a load of pints, and go hang out in the Shire. That's all we're going to do. This is what it means to be Irish, you know. We live in the green fields. Nothing bothers us. We're little people. Don't annoy us. We're good. And then all of a sudden, these Sauron, this Isengard, these evil, dark forces, the British, they just come in out of nowhere, completely psychotically possessed by just this idea that I just need to destroy these hobbits. These hobbits must be killed. They must be starved. I must exploit them. And from our perspective, this makes sense. It seems like these Saurons, these British people, these Englishmen, they're just possessed by a pure, unadulterated sense of insane levels of evil. They just want to kill us for no reason whatsoever. That doesn't seem logical. They're just driven mad by a demonic force. They're Satan himself manifest in the world. And this is the stories that we tell ourselves. These evil, irrational, monstrous, clownish, arrogant British people. They are coming in to attack us noble, us funny, kind, down-to-earth, humble hobbits. And this is the narrative that we get. And when you grow up in Ireland, this is the way that reality itself is presented to you. And you're not aware of it because it's very unconscious. It's the frame of the whole story is so magnificent, so complete, so real that you can't really understand that this is what you're getting shown. And so you get taught a set of virtues, a set of virtues, a set of ideas about yourself, an identity that's very suitable to this. To be Irish is to be, you know, witty, to be down to earth, to be humble, to be very hobbit-like, you know, very grounded. And what's interesting is that things like ambition, things like this sort of irrational desire to conquer, this desire to win, this desire to go after things, these things are all seen as the traits that the British have, you know, and they're often counter-signaled. They're often cut down an awful lot. Now, to explain this to people who aren't Irish, Ireland has a bit of a problem of being a graveyard of ambition. And this is a consequence of our character, probably because of all these experiences of slavery in the past. So we have a very biting, sharp, sarcastic wit. We have a very grounded and humble way about ourselves, very much like hobbits. But we do have this tendency to try grab people who get ahead of themselves. We could call it maybe a crab in the bucket mentality as well. Somebody starts to get too big-headed, starts to get too arrogant, starts to believe in themselves too much, starts to get these notions that they can do great things. And we'll laugh at them, we'll make fun of them, we'll use that incredible, sharp, sarcastic wit to try cut them down, to make them realize that they can't do that. You're just like one of us. You're a hobbit. You're not something else. You're not some amazing, you know, American who can just do whatever you want. You're not some British lord who owns the entire reality in the world. You're not that person. You're a fucking hobbit like all the rest of us. Get your fucking ass down here and drink the pint of Guinness and shut the fuck up and sit in the corner. And this biting thing is very, very toxic, because if you grow up with ambition, well, what's going to happen is you're not going to be able to express yourself, fulfill your identity in this culture. This culture will try to strangle you, try to hold you down. And we, of course, have a very big tradition of Irish people moving to places like America. And this is actually one of the reasons when you talk to people leave Ireland an awful lot, because of this very heavy down-pulling culture, this crab-in-the-bucket mentality. Two famous examples of this are Conor McGregor and Bono. Bono was one of the most popular musicians in the world at one point, and everybody in Ireland hates him. I have so many stories of people in Ireland meeting Bono and doing really petty, nasty things to him. Like, he would come over and say, for example, he's in a school, he's like, where's the bathroom, you know? And the person would just give him the wrong directions, just out of pure spite the fact that he's Bono, and he's rich, and he's arrogant, and he's successful. And they're like, oh, that dickhead, you know, he's so big-headed, he's so successful, they're just nasty to him. There's no natural respect. Instead, there's no admiration, there's no sort of like hope. It's like, he made it big, maybe I can make it too. Instead, there's this nasty pettiness where you want to cut Bono down. Conor McGregor is very the same. Now, Conor McGregor is a little bit more of a wild man, and he was loved on some level, but he is very much hated now. Like, an awful lot of people in Ireland don't like him anymore. And I even remember during his come up, like, an awful lot of us youth, the male youth especially, we all loved him. But many people who are a little bit older, they would always call him like, oh, he looks weird. Oh, who do you think he is? Now, to further illustrate this, I'd like to use an example of my American friends, because you Americans don't understand how different you are compared to us Irish. We Irish have a sort of sarcastic, almost disrespectful view of Americans sometimes. We see you as a little bit, you know, naive and silly and childish. And we see you as like a little bit out of touch. We have this very grounded, biting, sharp humor. We're very sarcastic. You don't tend to have that. You tend to be an awful lot more raw and honest and truth-telling, which also kind of makes you more, you know, out of touch and not really, you know, you're not really sharp in the way that we are. But our advantage comes from this natural pessimism that we have, this pettiness inside of us. Whereas you Americans are the exact opposite. You have a can-do attitude. It's amazing to come across it. Like, in America, I would notice with American people that you can say stuff like, yeah, bro, you know, I might just build a rocket ship in my back garden, dude. I was just like fucking talking with the bros, like, we were drinking some buds, and then we said, like, we'll build a fucking rocket ship, man. Or like, I think I'm gonna buy a car that's like the same size as my house, dude. Like, let's go for it. And the response to this is not, would you calm down there, like, and stop getting ahead of yourself. There's never that energy that is thrown at the American. Instead, the American is almost like, yeah, buddy, yeah, go for it, dude. Let's fucking go, man. Fucking American patriots. Yeah, yeah. Fucking freedom, man. Let's do it. And there's this positive reinforcement. There's this go for it type of energy. And of course, I think this is because the Americans are essentially the master race of the world. They're the hegemonic world power, the conquerors of the modern 20th century and 21st century. So there's this great, massive optimism inside of them that's naturally there. But it's an amazing thing to contrast with this Irish pessimism, with this held back, reserved, kind of dark way of seeing things. This graveyard of ambition versus the world of ambition. Now, as an Irish person, it's incredibly hard for me to become aware of these things, to become self-conscious of what I am, to become self-conscious of what I've grown up in and this story that is presented to me as reality in this culture, because it is my culture. I am drenched in it. I am saturated in it. It's the entire framing of my world perspective. I am Irish. I am told I am Irish. The songs I have tell me this story about these evil English people who just came in and started to hurt my feelings and stuff like this. The jokes, the humor, the sarcasm, the way people look at you, the culture, it's everywhere. It's pure saturation, and it installs these perspectives, this pettiness, this hobbit-like attitude. And so the first step for me to become awake is to learn that there's other ways that you can look at reality. And one of the most emotionally powerful ways for me to do this is to try, of all things, understand the perspective of Sauron, of evil itself, to try flip the story on its head. Is there a way that I can look at reality and understand why the English acted the way they acted? So think about this. I have to now make a new movie altogether about the story of history, about the war between Ireland and England. I have to make this whole new film about this. And instead I have to start over in London or in Nottingham or in Birmingham, wherever it is these fucking Brits live, whatever it is. I have to try ground myself in that perspective and understand the way that they see the world that allows them to go over and oppress somebody like the Irish, like me. Allows them to go do the crazy stuff they did, like take over the world. And that's a very difficult thing to do because that's just beyond the way that I think. It's not how I, as an oppressed, traumatized slave, understand reality. So what I'm trying to do here is take on the conqueror's or the master's perspective and understand the structure of his value system that allows this Englishman to think that he's making the right choice, he's doing the good thing, because he definitely believes that on some level. And this is very strange. I have to reevaluate my entire conception of morality and understand the master's morality. Now, the first thing that I'd notice here is how little the English care about the Irish. In our story, the English are Sauron himself. He's the biggest deal ever. He's like the big, big dude that everyone's looking at as this terrible monster. But when you talk to English people, when you come to understand their history, Ireland is not a big deal at all. It's just another colony. Well, whereas they have loads of different enemies. They have the French they're fighting against the whole time. They're dealing with people like the Russians. They're bickering with the Spanish. The Irish are just this kind of part of the big puzzle that they're leading. The Indians are another colony. South Africa, Australia, Hong Kong. They have a lot of stuff going on. And it kind of turns into this meme where I, as the Irish guy, is like that dude who's saying, I feel really bad for you. And then the other guy goes, I don't think about you at all. Now, another thing you'll notice is an instinctive trust about the righteousness of expressing power in a very sophisticated way. Not just this idea of bullying people or oppressing people, but instead they feel that power is the foundation towards creating higher things, higher culture. And this is very hard for the slave to take. But most of Ireland's most developed areas are a consequence of invaders taking control of places and building things. Most of the major cities in Ireland were created by the Viking conquerors. Dublin, Wexford, Waterford, Cork, Limerick. These were all crafted by invading, organizing supermen who came in and built things. They started to build castles. Much of the Irish hobbit peasantry was always a little bit more agrarian and backwards, and they weren't building these magnificent castles. And we could say that's because they were oppressed, but there has to come a kind of question that at some point in the world of open competition, either you're going to get yourself organized eventually and start to show that you're really this supreme, you know, supermen that are going to start building all these castles, or we have to take an objective stance on this and say, well, look, you're not really doing anything. And these creators, these organizing forces that came from the outside, outside and conquered you. They were the ones who actually started to build everything that sent the civilization forward. To give you an example of this, it's from Monty Python. Monty Python has this sketch about the Jews organizing a rebellion against Rome. It's The Life of Brian. During the time of, you know, they're making fun of the time of Jesus. And the Jews, they all gather together in this little house, and they're forming a rebellion, you know, about how they're going to get down against the Romans. And one of the guys goes, John Cleese goes, "What did the Romans ever do for us anyway?" And one of the other Jews goes, "Hospitals, roads, buildings, writing, public health things, officiation, the police, more protection, crimes down." They just list off all these things that the master race, the oppressive tyrants, brought as a benefit. And they're exposing to these Jews that it's like, listen, bros, you were like, you know, backwards religious fanatics before these Romans showed up and actually, quote unquote, civilized you and started to create a higher order and started to lift your culture up and create these new and profound and powerful things. And us Irish actually have to deal with this too. We can sit around and we can say, oh well, we never built Paris because the English always had us under our foot. But it's like, look, at some point you got to actually take the responsibility here, because it seems like we're very pessimistic, we're very lazy, like we have these traits that we shouldn't be proud of that probably hold us back a little bit. And these conquering people come in and they beat us in the world of fighting, and then they order what's going on, and then they start to build these hospitals and these roads and these cities and these magnificent specimens of culture. And all these major cities built by these outsiders, by these conquering foreigners, are essentially the economic hubs of Ireland to this day. And so what the Englishman has is this ambition, this big perspective. He has a clear conscience about expressing his power, and he wants the world, and he wants it now. And he's not afraid to take bombastic risks. He's not afraid of getting on a boat and sailing over and trying to attack an army larger than his and keeping his people more organized and using advanced technology to make sure that they win. He's not afraid of having a pair of balls. He's not afraid for aiming big. He's not afraid for sailing all around the world in these massively risky voyages and in putting people to the sword and conquering them. He's focused on civilization. He's focused on ordering principles. He's focused on culturing people. He's focused on bringing in the concepts of higher truths and higher realities. In fact, the Englishman has a very moral conception of himself, extremely moral. He doesn't see himself as Sauron. In fact, when you really dig into English culture, they're almost sickening. Nietzsche himself would sort of say they're nearly too liberal, you know? They're sickening because they're here talking about, like, we should abolish slavery and we should open up hospitals all across all of our colonies so that everybody can do well. And it's like, They're obsessed about this idea that they're redeeming the world, they're lifting the world up with their civilizing powers. And actually, these Englishmen, they're very aware of our pettiness. They see inside of the slaves in the Irish the lack of ambition, the lack of these organizational forces, the lack of the will to create, the will to reach beyond yourself. They see this lower pettiness, this hobbling around and acting like a hobbit. And they don't respect it. They see it as something that's quite nasty. And in fact, obviously the Irish have an awful lot of resentment towards the English because they've been conquered. But all the English experience is that resentment. They see this nasty, bitter resentment getting presented to them. They see these Irish people snapping at their heels the whole time, you know, attacking them. And they see it as a petty trait. Just like the Romans probably looked at the Jews. The Romans had an awful lot of things going on, and they come in contact with these Jews, and these Jews are just fanatically outraged at them. They hate them beyond all comprehensible measure. They give them these hospitals and all these types of things, and it just doesn't seem to ever be enough. And they're just like, these dudes are fucking crazy. And they're useless as well on top of this too. And so they're, in their moral schema, they don't see the Irish as evil. There is no Sauron in their way of seeing the world. That's not a reality for them. That story doesn't exist. They have a much different story. Their story, their perspective, their good and evil is this idea of the righteousness of bringing the light into the world. They're sort of like, you know, the expression of their will to power in the world is the righteous way that they conduct themselves. And of course, what they see is not something that is evil, but something that is actually pathetic and wimpy and weak and dishonest and petty. And that's the conception of bad in their way of seeing things. things. Now, this is something that Nietzsche spoke about at length in a book called Genealogy of Morals, Essay 1. This fascinating philology, so the study of words that he did, where he finds that the ancient Greeks, at the top of their hierarchy, at the top of their classes, never had this way of saying things like good and evil. That just didn't really exist. The word good and evil was more related to this idea of, you know, the strong, the healthy, the clear conscience, the powerful, the righteous, the honest, and then the petty lower classes, liars and deceivers. And it's because they had this same conception going on in ancient Greece, where the people who conquered ancient Sparta and ancient Greece saw themselves as the honest ones who were naturally expressing their power and going after the truth and creating reality. And they saw the slaves, the people who were conquered, as these petty liars, these little hobbits who rationalize the fact that they don't have any ambition and try to create silly stories to make themselves feel better about themselves instead of actually embracing reality and going for things. If you would like a feel for this in modern language, think about how we use the word poor. Poor can be you're impoverished, you have no money, you know, you're lower class. Poor can actually also mean pity, you know. Oh, poor you, poor little guy, poor little dog. So it's like you feel sorry for them. And poor can also mean bad attempt, so low standard. Oh, that was a poor shot at goal. That was a poor attempt. Now, this really shows you this idea here, because poor is essentially a version of bad, a version of negative, but it's not, got no connotations about evil. It's wrapped up with pity, patheticness, incompetence, low standards, lower class, poverty. There's no conception of it being Sauron. It's not some evil force. Instead, it's just the sloppiness of the lower, the sloppiness of the wimps and the pathetic. Now, this is the conception that the rich, the masters, the conquerors, the winners have of the world. They don't see Satan. They don't see Sauron. They don't see great evils. They don't see these obnoxious binaries. That's stuff only that slaves experience. Instead, they see these people as, you know, they see the weak and the incompetent and the lazy. And then they see those who are organized and strong and who have a clear conscience about expressing power and giving purpose and destiny to the world. That's such a fascinating breakout of the entire story that I was told growing up. And so Nietzsche, the German incel psychologist, encourages us to break out of our conceptual paradigms and learn to see things from a whole new perspective, and genuinely do that in a way that is shocking to us, that invalidates our moral framework, which is one of the most emotionally intense things that you can ever do. To get an Irishman to try flip the story on its head and understand what it means to be British and what it means to see things from the master's perspective, from the master morality world conception. And of course, it's no harm for an English person to try to do the same thing, to try break it out and say, how am I looking at reality? And what exactly might these Irish hobbits be experiencing and what's going on there? Now, this is where we begin to answer our question about why Western people are so shackled with guilt. And this is because the master races of the world already are looking at the world from the perspective of the slaves, of the victims. You see, taking on a different perspective can have extremely serious emotional consequences. I, living as a slave, experience an awful lot of negative emotions. I feel an awful lot of bitterness, envy, and resentment. I feel an awful lot of self-pity. I feel an awful lot of depression and weakness. I feel an awful lot of incompetence. I feel an awful lot of frustration and anger because my perspective is about this evil tyrant oppressing me, and there's barely anything I can do about it except for hide in the corner and say that there's this big, bad, dominant Superman taking over my reality. And if I can break out of that paradigm and learn to see this conquering perspective, this master morality that has a good, clear conscience about power, that says to you that ambition is righteous, that you should find the deepest, most brave part of yourself, the highest, most ordered part of yourself, and release it upon the world and fight to be able to make space in reality for you to express that. That just shatters my entire world vision. It destroys every conception of myself that I have. If I learn from this new perspective that much of this petty sarcasm and this little thinking, this petty thinking that you see is actually holding me back from embracing that destiny and is causing me to be a loser, I can break free from that and go after higher ambitions and transform my reality and go and ascend and reach and basically lift off out of my previous paradigm. paradigm. It's very, very useful for a slave to start to understand how a master thinks. This would be put in a simpler analogy, like how a loser can learn to think like a winner. You have a guy who's a professional UFC fighter and he's winning all the time, and you go and you talk to him and you'll see that his perspective on things is very assertive. He believes in his own destiny, his own responsibility. He's accountable for his actions. He's accountable for his reality. He believes in his right to decide if he throws the punch or not. He has agency in this world. You talk to a guy who's constantly losing his fight and you'll notice that his mind, you know, he's depressed. Maybe he doesn't even compete at all. He's overweight. He's something like this. He will have this way of seeing reality that's very damaged, that's very negative, that's very self-hating, that's full of negative emotions. Now, if you were to swap their brains, maybe brains is too much, but if you could somehow get their minds, their perspectives on reality, and just, you know, put one in a USB stick and then move it into the other guy and swap them around, you would probably see the championship UFC fighter would begin to lose consistently and eventually just fall off the map. And then the depressed dude would probably start hitting the gym. He'd probably start hitting the gym and getting in shape and getting bigger and getting stronger, and he started to believe in himself and he started to go for his goals, because this perspective that you take on reality has that much of an effect. Now think about this at the scale of people. I, the slave, takes on the winner's perspective, and I actually begin to see the world with more agency, with more clear conscience about expressing my power, and I'm able to go after reality. If the master starts seeing my perspective, if the master starts seeing the depressed person's perspective, what happens to him? Now, you might think the master starts feeling resentment, the master starts feeling self-pity, the master starts feeling all the emotions the slave feels, frustration. But it's actually more significant and subtle than this, because in the slave's perspective, in the story that the slave is telling about reality, the master is not the hobbit. The master is Sauron. So if the master, if England is to believe the Irish perspective, the English have to take on the role of Sauron. They have to develop this identity that they are evil. So the prominent emotion they feel is not resentment. They don't feel the same as what the slave feels. They feel a different emotion. They feel guilt. They feel shame and guilt for being evil, for being this horrible entity. They feel negative feelings about themselves. And think again, what does this story say? What does the slave's perspective say? What does the Hobbit tell you? That Sauron is possessed by some demonic force. Sauron has this toxic evilness inside of himself. And this evilness is represented as Sauron's lust for power. This instinct inside of Sauron is twisted. Now, why is this so dangerous? Because this is the exact instinct in the master's perspective that is the empowering part of him. The master's clear conscience, the master's natural trust for his instincts, his own soul. His soul says, I want to ambitiously create a new reality. I want to spread my reality out into the world. I believe in myself. This confidence, this pride, this assertiveness to express your will, to launch yourself upon the world. These instincts, these are good in the master's perspective, and they lead to the creation of these giant cultures. It leads to the redemption and the lifting up of the cultural paradigm of the world. This is demonized. This is told to be the source of absolute evil, because it's that same instinct in the master, when it's released, that actually does hurt the slave. So of course the slave is completely logical to call that ugly and evil and bad. But if the master believes that, this destroys him. Destroys him. Why? Because the master's conscience, his mind, his understanding of his instincts, his soul, gets completely distorted. He goes from having a what we call a good conscience or a clear conscience to having a bad conscience or a guilty conscience. He goes from being able to listen to his impulses and his instincts, the source of life inside of himself, listening to his own will, his source of assertive life. He goes from being able to trust that and listen to that and not question that, to literally thinking that everything that comes out of him is fully evil. And this makes him attack himself. His conscience, his mind switches on all of a sudden. When he hears that voice inside of himself being like, make them drink tea. Conquer them and force them to drink tea, brothers. We must build a ship and bring tea to the world. We must civilize them with knives and forks. when he hears those voices inside of himself, the schizophrenic voices of English will to power, he suddenly has this other voice inside of his head, the perspective, the slave's voice. And he's like, that's Sauron talking. That's the instinct that made you Sauron. And he goes to war against himself. And he feels bad. He has this new feeling that rises up, that begins to fight inside of himself. And it grabs his soul and it crushes it down. And he gets a new story. And this feeling is guilt. This feeling is the depressing feeling. The feeling of power getting restricted and pulled down and deadened. The feeling of not wanting to win, not wanting to believe in yourself, not wanting to go after your culture, not being proud of yourself, instead being ashamed of yourself, instead hating yourself. Not believing in your right to go out into the world and spread your seed and create and breed and see your forms manifest in the world. Instead, that's all put aside. That's all crushed. That's all destroyed. That's all stifled down. Now, at this point in your therapy session with Dr. Nietzsche, you're probably like, dude, this is just too bizarre. This is too crazy. Just give me the SSRIs. I'm good. Just put me on the drugs. Numb me to this. I don't have to deal with this stuff. Master, slave, Sauron. Why are we talking about Lord of the Rings? Just drug me up, man. Send me out that door. I want to be happy. I don't want to know. I don't want to know anything anymore. I don't want to be conscious. I want you to turn off my GABA receptors and turn off my serotonin receptors and just allow me to live in bliss. That's what I'm here for. Why are you talking to me about world perspectives and morality? But I'm afraid you can't leave. You have to strap yourself in because it gets even worse. You see, this dialectic between master and slave tells us an awful lot about the rise and fall of empires. And you will notice when you study empires that they never really have these problems at the start. At the beginning of the empire, there's usually quite a strong, clear conscience. But towards the end is where many of these problems show up. The best example of this would be the Roman Empire. The Roman Empire begins with the Romans having a clear master morality. They emerge out of the Italian peninsula, thirsty, hungry for pasta, looking for espressos and pizzas, and they can't find them, so they go fucking crazy. They go absolutely mad, and they start to worship Mars. They summon up this supreme power. They worship power itself, and they have a very clear conscience about this. And they go and they assert themselves and their neighbors, and they begin to conquer everything around them. And they see nothing wrong with this. They have a master's perspective, a master morality. They see that they are bringing the light of Rome to the world. They're expressing their Roman power, and it's good to do this because the people around them are all barbarian plebs. They're either Gauls up north who run around in nappies, or they're Greeks who run around in towels. And instead, these people are supermen. These are Romans who are bringing civilization, bringing architecture, bringing power. And for centuries, for millennia, these Romans are winning. They're doing fantastic. There's no problems at all. They come across, of course, utter enemies, but they always believe in themselves. Even during the Great War of Hannibal, when Carthage comes up and he brings elephants, and he almost destroys Rome. He defeats their armies and everything, and they're almost lost. Almost all the men are dead at one point. They still win because they believe in themselves, because they feel that will to power so strongly that they are going to fight to the last man. And this will, this power means that they succeed. And this is actually something that leads to them doing very, very well, is that they're just persistent. They keep showing up and then they beat Carthage down and then they end up destroying them. And this is never a problem. Their moralization is never a problem until the end, until they get very, very rich and they have a couple of hundred years of just unbelievable wealth, unbelievable abundance, unbelievable success. And at this point, they get soft, as all people do. And at that, you start to lose a little bit of that edge. You lose a little bit about that consciousness of power. Your energy drops a little bit. And what's so interesting is that always starts this desire to understand other cultures. The Romans then start to get more into the Greeks. The Greeks become very high status. They start to pay more attention to the Greeks. They start to bring in more slaves from across the empire. So you start getting these Gauls and these Germans start to marry, you know, people who are high status and whatnot. And then these people come from the Middle East and it's the same thing. And then you start to learn about all these other cultures. And it eventually turns into this thing where these other cultures are more fashionable. They're more stylish. They're more cool than the native Roman things. Native Roman things are kind of like boring pasta, ragu, bolognese. Who gives a fuck about that shit, man? We've eaten that for 500 years. I want Lebanese breads or whatever it is. I want to eat French croissants. You know, I'm not sure the world looked like this back then, but we'll go with it anyway. I want to do things differently. And so there begins to be this love for the other. And with this love for the other and this sort of hate for yourself begins this introduction into the interest in the other's perspective. The other's perspective becomes sexy, romantic, foreign. It's very similar to how we have so many people in the West who love Indian religions. Oh, the Indian religions, how stylish, how cool. I can't wait to go over to India and learn about Hinduism. I'm going to get these tattoos that say like chicken curry in Hindu symbols or something like this. There's this love for the other. And of course, this love for the other opens up the Roman's mind to alternate perspectives, to other ways of seeing reality, to perspectives that are different than the one that put them in power, just like the losers and the winners. It's weirdly, these Romans go to places like Judea and they check out these other perspectives that open them up to a perspective of a people who were conquered by them. They open themselves up to the perspectives of a loser. Now, this shouldn't be a problem. If you are strong, you believe in yourself, you're self-assertive, you shouldn't be afraid of other perspectives. This is something Nietzsche wants to point out, is that if you're spiritually strong, you're well able of confronting alternate realities and integrating them. This is one of the foundations of his idea of a philosophy of the future. But if you're weak, if you do not believe in yourself, if your will to power has fallen, you're in great danger. Because you might get entranced by this other perspective. You might believe the perspective of a depressed person on what's going to happen to you, like we said before. And this is exactly what happens to Rome, actually to a profound extent. The Judean perspective, one of the slave races that was conquered by Rome, ends up becoming the world perspective installed in Rome. So dramatically that the entire religion, which is related to these perspectives, religion and perspectives are almost the same thing, gets replaced in Rome. Mars, Zeus, them dudes are booted out the door. They're considered demons, evil. They're considered Sauron. Oh, they're terrible things. And instead, this new perspective is put into place. And what is put into place? Well, it's not trivial. What is put into place is a cross, is a crucifix, is a story about guilt, is a story about how you Romans aligned with our local political powers and killed a poor little slave. You took up a slave and you stuck him on a cross. You should feel guilty. You should learn to see things from his perspective. You should learn to see things from our perspective. Think about what you have done to us, the slaves. Think about the victims of your monstrous way of conducting yourself in the world. And this saturates Rome. This transforms Rome's whole understanding of themselves. The Romans all of a sudden are all captivated by this new world perspective. And as this is happening, they become weaker and weaker and weaker until they basically implode. They can no longer employ people for the army. They won't even fight and defend themselves anymore. They don't understand themselves. It all becomes this massive mess. And then eventually barbarians knock down the gates and destroy the whole empire for the first time. Ever. The first time in 800 years, they finally just kick it down and plunder it. Now, I always get in trouble for this. This is not to say that the slave perspective, that Christianity or something like that, killed off Rome. It's merely a phenomenon that seems to show up at the end of these things. Many trends led to Rome to get to this point. You know, they were playing around with their currency. They were very, very wealthy and abundant. And this leads to a general softness that happens all the time. But then at the end, one of the symptoms of this decline is this rising up of the slave perspective. It's a fascinating thing. The empathy for the other. The master becoming guilty. The crucifix is a symbol of guilt that's put at the center. Instead of a symbol of power, instead of a symbol of Mars, of conquest, there's a symbol of guilt put in its place. And it's not trivial. It happens right as Rome collapses. That doesn't matter. Bickering about history is not important. What is important is what this can tell us about what is happening right now in the West. Because we are living through the exact same archetypal experience. We had these European colonialists who exploded out of the European peninsula and launched themselves upon the world like the blonde beast of prey that Nietzsche talked about. They were full of that Martian energy. They were full of that lion soul that launched itself on all of reality. And this was the, you know, a load of pirates who hopped onto their boats and conquered Ireland and conquered the Americas, conquered Mexico and then all of the Americas, conquered India, conquered Australia, conquered all of Africa, conquered most of Asia as well. These blonde beasts, these lions that leaped out of Europe, these were the Martian monsters. These people, they might have been Christian, sure, but they certainly weren't Christian in practice. These were savages. These were primal men, full of will to power, with a clear conscience about their right to go seeking gold and plunder and territory and trade and victory. They had no qualms about going out there for the sake of power and winning and asserting themselves upon reality. And their world conception was that they were bringing civilization to the world. They often would say to themselves, you know, we're bringing Christ to the world. We're bringing Christianity, which is civilization, to the world. It's very fun how they spin this, you know. They go out to Mexico and they butcher all these people and they kill all these people on these islands, or they go out to Africa and do the same thing and they start these slave trades. And it's like, well, you know, I know we're enslaving them. I know we're murdering them. I know we're stealing their women. You know, read Columbus's diaries if you want to read about that. But we're doing it for Christ. We're civilizing them, because that's the conscience that they sort of bring to it as well. And what follows after this is centuries of incredible abundance. The European people literally run the world. They can take resources from everywhere, and they create out of this super technological societies. They create the operations of big capital. They create wealth that is beyond belief. They make spaceships. They lift themselves up to a new level. They go higher than even Rome itself went. But after 500 years, this incredible abundance leads to the same softening that always happens, the same as what happened in Rome. And during the 20th century, you see this urge rise up inside Western people for the other. They become interested in things that are foreign. They want to learn a little bit more about the victims of history. They want to become interested in African music and African culture. They want to understand the Jewish struggle. They want to learn about Irish people. They want to learn about our, you know, folk music. Our Irish folk music becomes very, very popular. A great example of this is the musical trends of the 20th century compared to, for example, the 19th century. In the 19th century, you had Romanticism, where you had like Austro-Hungarian composers. You had like German supermen. You had like Wagner, you know. You had all these master races producing this high symphonic, super ordered music, this very, very dramatic and powerful stuff, very, very moving romantic stuff. And then you go into the 20th century and that's all of a sudden become uncool. People are not interested anymore. That's stodgy and old. That's, you know, this European, dusty, boring old stuff from the old world. And all of a sudden there's this rise of these new styles of music. Jazz shows up, and jazz is an expression of diversity. Jazz is celebrated as something that gets African Americans and Jewish Americans working together to produce their music. You see black African blues music and folkish Irish music mixed together again with this jazz. They create this sort of hodgepodge, diverse, new style of music, rock music, in the 60s, which turns into this new paradigm for this whole new world. And this is the rising of this alternate perspective. And wrapped up all around this is this feeling of overcoming the stodgy old European way, and this introduction of this new culture, this new way of seeing things, which is open to the African-American experience, the African experience, the black experience, which is open to Jewish music and Jewish styles, which is open to, you know, Irish folk music and Irish styles. It's open to the minorities, to the other. It is interested in seeing their perspective. And this new style is very seductive for the old master races, the Anglo-Americans, the English, the Germans, the French. They all capitulate and run along with this new popular music and its diverse new messaging. Now, I'm obviously not saying that music is the cause of all this. It's just one poignant example of this phenomenon showing up in the 20th century. Instead, what you see across the board in all different ways, across culture and attitudes generally, in fiction, in academia, in intellectual spheres, is the beginning of this appreciation for the victim's perspective. This desire to understand what happened in the past, to see the world historical narrative, not from the perspective of these colonizing Europeans who took over the world, these supermen in their ships, these blonde beasts of prey, but instead to take a critical perspective on this and look at history and understand the plight of the Africans as they got pulled out of their homelands and enslaved, to take and look at the plight of the Jews in Europe as they struggled as these people outside of the historical narrative, to look at the Irish who got famined, who got all their potatoes stolen from them, and to feel shame for this. This is the point of this video. You
motherfuckers. I want to hear a lot of apologies in the comments about the whole potato thing, guys. Just because I can see all this stuff doesn't mean I'm over it. I'm not spiritually mature enough to get over this stuff. I want sorry for what happened to my potatoes being written down there. And you see this fascination with victim perspectives. And now, at our current moment, this is actually reaching a cadence. These things have been in the works for maybe a century at this point. You know, the beginnings of this stuff started in the 1920s, and it was rumbling forward, and you see the beginnings of it in the 19th century. But it would, Western culture was still very strong at that point. It was sort of at its peak. But that stuff began to snowball. And now we're at this place where the victim's perspective has gotten so strong that it has taken over the master's self-confidence. Now, this is significant. This is religious in its size, because this is basically Western culture at this point. What you're seeing in the modern world is the redemption, or the lifting up of minority perspectives, and the pulling down of the Western perspective. The victim's story and experience is being turned into the only perspective that is valid, and the moral construction of our reality is premised on the victim's perspective. The moral construction that led to the rising of Western civilization, which was that Martian energy that we were talking about that Rome had, or that powerful conquering energy that the Europeans had when they were exploding out of Europe at that time, that energy is bluntly conceptualized as evil. It is Sauron's perspective. The energy that caused these Europeans to want to go take over the world, you've heard this before, was this instinctive, horrible evil inside of them. And the only way that they can make up for what they did is to feel guilt about that energy, to throw away that master perspective, to throw away that master morality, to learn that what they did was wrong, and to develop this capacity to see the world from the perspective of their victims. It's exactly what happened with Christianity at the end of Rome. To see the struggle of the slave, to see the struggle of the Irishman, to see the struggle of the Jew, to see these experiences and understand that the demons in those stories were them, were you. And the only thing that you can do is to feel guilt. When you feel those same instincts rising up, it's the same story. You must feel guilt, and you must crush them down, and you must choose to do something else. You must use your conscience to beat down your own instincts, and use your creative power not to help yourself to release your forms, but instead to help the other, to appreciate the other, to lift up the other, because their perspective is what matters. You have to save the hobbits. The only righteous thing for you to do is not to try to release yourself upon the world and conquer and organize the world and bring hospitals and roads. Instead, you must help the Irishman grow potatoes. That's what you must do in modern Europe. And you see, this is saturated all of Western culture. All of our cultural goals are premised on this. The goal of diversity hiring, the goal of the equity that we want to place in society, all this discussion about reparations going on over in America, the discussion about climate change and how we need to protect the earth and protect the horrific things that European capitalism has done to the world. This is all coming from the same perspective of self-sacrifice, moral self-sacrifice by Western man for something else, because of the narrative that he is evil. And so, instead of the crucifixion that was installed inside of the Roman's mind, now the European walks around and he sees images of slavery. He sees the Africans in their chains on their ships, getting tortured, getting beaten. Some of them are getting thrown into the ocean, these horrible things, and they're drowning, and these guys in their fancy European feathered hats are laughing at them. They look inside their mind, they see the Germans in their sharp uniforms putting people in ovens. They see them in the Holocaust stacking up these dead bodies. They see the Irishman holding his potatoes, looking at them going all brown, and then the ships are leaving the harbour so they can go off to somewhere else. The Indian who feels himself oppressed and conquered by the British, having all these red coats marching around and pointing guns at them and shooting them when they step out of order. This is what the European man sees inside of his conscience when he thinks about himself. He sees these are his versions of the crucifix, these versions of the cross. And this instantiates inside of himself this electric guilt, this shame, this self-destruction. He can't feel feel inside of himself this idea that he could be like Achilles, or he could be like the Vikings. He can't feel this Martian energy, this pagan, fiery roar inside of himself, or he wants to launch himself upon the world and do something incredible. He can't do that because he's got a guilty conscience. Those stories just don't exist in him anymore. They've been emotionally squashed out of him. He is like a Roman at the end of Rome. He doesn't believe in Mars anymore. He doesn't feel it. There's a new feeling inside of him, and it's this sad, stroppy guilt, this feeling of seeing what a monster he is inside of his head for torturing Jesus Christ and sticking him up on a cross, like the Romans did to millions of slaves throughout the extent of their empire. And this is what causes this self-hate, this hesitation. This is why this is happening to these European people. This is why when you go into Paris and you steal a French man's coffee or something like that, you take his beret off and you throw it in the distance, or you beat him over the head with a baguette, and if he gets mad, you just say, well, you know, like, I'm one of the slave races, and he's like, oh, sorry, oh, and he starts bowing on the floor or something like this. This is why this can happen. This is why during the BLM protest, you had people going kissing the feet, you know, like in these really ironic Christian religious worship. They're picking up people's feet and kissing them, kissing these black people's feet because they feel bad for, they're atoning, you know, it's a religious behavior. And this also shows us what religion is in some sense, because religion is driven by these psychological realities. People want to make religion all these other things that it is not. Religion is this. These feelings and these world perspectives are the absolute foundation of religion. And I think this is proven by looking at something like Christianity or atheism. Atheism claims intellectually that it's about not believing in God. But atheism follows this sentiment, this guilt complex exactly. This is the emotional tenor of that. You listen to many of these atheists and they will tell you a moral story that is based on these same emotions. They will tell you that it's, you know, the victim perspective is righteous and the European perspective, the master perspective was evil. They'll say that because that's what their world paradigm is, because that's what their actual religion is. That's the emotional tenor of their moral perspective. This is what Nietzsche would sort of be talking about. And then, of course, you talk to a Christian nowadays, not all of them, but most of them, and they will say the exact same thing. You know, you talk to a Christian and they will tell you that Christ was a representative of the minorities in the past, and he was showing the victim perspective, and that's what Christianity was actually about. And you go into church and you'll hear them talk about these things, and this is what they're talking about. They're talking about the lifting up of the victim perspective against the tyrants of the Pharisees and the tyrants of Rome. And this is showing that the religion is adapting and bending towards these psychological realities. That's how powerful these are. Our intellectual beliefs, you'd see these Christians and these atheists bickering with each other, but that stuff is just so unbelievably irrelevant, because they're bickering about these intellectual nonsense that has no real consequence when the muscular driving force is the feeling, the psychology, the passion, the world paradigm that is driving it all. That's the monster, that's the Leviathan that decides the moral outlook of the world. Intellectual stuff can always be bent and distorted by these things. They can always be reshaped with this. You see this with pagan religions, you know? You go into like Wodanist situations and you'll hear them, there's these like Wodan things on Facebook, and it's just so funny reading them, because like they'll put up these announcements and stuff and they'll be like, anybody can be a Wodenist, and we don't accept racism, we're all about diversity and all this. So you see these values, this world perspective and feeling, the victim perspective and feeling is in showing up everywhere, because it is the true religion. It's the thing that's behind the curtain. It's the frame that holds all these things together, and the ideologies just don't matter at all. Declared beliefs are, they just all capitulate to this in the end. And so at this point, maybe you'd say, okay, cool, it's religious, so we're screwed, nothing we can do about it, that's why we're guilty, it's all over, thank you Steph, anyway, I'm out of here. But it gets worse. You sit your ass down and listen. Another terrifying but beautiful observation that Dr. Nietzsche had was how we overcome this guilt in the end, the psychology of overcoming trauma. How do we deal with traumas like this? And of course, he would say, we need to forget it. We need to get over it. We need to let it go. He would talk about forgetfulness as being an incredible tool. Blessed are the forgetful, because they get the better even of their mistakes. The ability for us to Move on is a really, really powerful sign. And why is this? Because when you get traumatized, you essentially have a wound. And when you want to overcome that trauma, you need to be able to heal the wound. Now, how does your body heal a wound? Well, you know, you get a cut and it just heals up. It uses its resources to heal it up. But if your body is sick, or if you're old, or if you're diseased, or if you're low on nutrition, you might not be able to heal that wound. It might stay open, then it gets infected, then it might turn gangrenous, then we have to cut your arm off. If you aren't full of vitality, you're not able to forget about your trauma. Your trauma can become worse and it can fester and turn into something toxic. Now, that's a very serious thing to think about. And why would it be any different for psychological trauma? If something bad happens to me in my past, I certainly remember it and I want to take my lessons from it. But eventually I want to consolidate the experience, integrate the experience in Jungian's terms, and then move on. I want to be let free from the frustration and the negativity. I want to forget about it. As Nietzsche said in one of his most beautiful statements, "Blessed are the forgetful because they get the better even of their mistakes." And one of the traits he noticed in the masters, in the conquerors, was that they were very good at being forgetful. They never took things too seriously. You know, they were able to overcome pretty much anything, their slights, their pains. They had this good sportsman attitude towards life. You know, when you meet two fighters in the UFC and they're calling each other names and they're insulting each other and they're really, really like going hard. And then they fight and then they just forget about it. They don't hold a grudge. They're not, you know, nasty afterwards. They sort of just go for it, have a bit of crack. They put their lives on the line and then they step out of it and shake hands and be like, "Listen, dickhead, that was a good fight. Well done." They get over it. They forget about it. This is a trait of a master, trait of somebody who's abundantly strong, trait of somebody who has a strong mind. Now, of course, a loser, somebody who's deeply traumatized, you know, say you're going up and you meet this UFC fighter and he calls you, he says you're weak or you're skinny, you look silly or something like this. He says, "Oh, you look all skinny fat. You look like a dork." This might be an incredibly difficult psychological problem for you, because maybe you were struggled in high school to get girls because you look like a dork. And so you develop all this neurosis about it. And you remember this one word that he said to you. And for the rest of your, you know, the rest of your days, you're festering. You go home and it's like this open wound that won't heal. You don't have the psychological strength to get over it and move on with your life. And so his words echo in your head and you're like, "Oh, what a dickhead." And then maybe, like, you know, 5 years later, you strap yourself with dynamite and run up and blow yourself up in front of him and take the guy out or something like this. And people are like, "What the hell went down? That was crazy. That dude just went crazy with hate." And this is the example of somebody who doesn't have the willpower to overcome that type of pain. Now, when it comes to peoples, what you'll be surprised to find is that no race is some type of eternal, ever-present master race. All races tend to have some type of trauma in their past. The great big bad British were enslaved by the Romans. They were eventually enslaved by the Anglo-Saxons, and then they were enslaved by the Vikings, and then they were enslaved by the French. They were conquered plenty. And their ability to overcome that and let it go and move on and allow themselves to release themselves into the future was a testament to their strength, their ability to overcome this trauma. And they were able to forgive and forget. It's a trait of a conqueror to let it go and move on instead of getting stultified and trapped by the experience. This is something that as a slave race we have to confront. You know, me as the Irish person, I can't sit around bickering about the famine. I can't let my trauma define me. I can't allow my culture, this is, you know, what us Irish people have to deal with. We can't allow ourselves to think like losers forever. We have to overcome this. We have to learn to let go. But the struggle for us is that it's incredibly hard, especially when you are losing, because loss equals pain. To live under the foot of the British means you lose your girl, you get humiliated, you get bullied, you get forced to work for somebody else, you have to pay them taxes, you have to pay them debt. It's horrible. And the pain burns itself into us every single day. We're getting prodded with iron, hot irons all day, every day of the trauma, of the humiliation. And this forces us to remember. The pain causes consciousness. And this is something Nietzsche observed. Something very fascinating is that the slaves tend to be a little bit more savvy, a little bit more sly like the fox, a little bit more cruel even, and a little bit more aware of reality. They're able to think more long term because they have a bit more depth and consciousness because of their position of being in pain all the time. They have to sit down in this torture state of being humiliated, asking themselves, who am I? What is happening? Why is this happening to me? Pain and trauma causes consciousness. Pain causes memory. And then there's the flip side of this. Such a fascinating problem on the other end. You see, this forgetfulness, this ability to let things go that the master has, is an incredible trait. To forgive and forget, something Jesus Christ possessed in quite an ironic and profound way. A slave who represented master morality. Forgive those, turn the other cheek. Pure forgiveness, pure forgetfulness, pure moving on from the trauma. Very fascinating that. But that trait can lead to naivety. This naivety is something you see an awful lot in the master races. For a variety of different reasons. First of all, they're instinctively prone to letting things go, to moving on, to turning the other cheek, to taking the stoic punch in the face and going for the win. They're built into them is this natural forgetfulness. They are blessed with this good ability to deal with pain because they're full of vitality. They're not afraid of trauma. They're not afraid of these things and they can move on. They don't hold grudges. They're not envious and resentful. They're conquerors. They move forward. They attack. They go for what they want. But of course, top this with a large amount of abundance. You know, their ancestors conquer the entire world and then they get to reap all those resources back into their nation, back into their country. And they grow up and they have all the food they could ever want and they're pampered and they have no pain. This forgetfulness can also be then paired with no experience of pain, no trauma, no reason for them to struggle. And so they become a little bit naive. They lose touch with reality. They become a little bit clueless. They become a little bit unaware of the darkness inside some people in life. And this naivety becomes the fatal flaw in the master. Because the master naively takes upon the perspective of these victims. They shackle themselves with guilt. And they make the mistake of thinking that the victims that they're in an interaction with have the same world-building ambitions that they have. They think that these victims that they're trying to rise up to their level want to continue the project of building this great civilization that they've built and building all these hospitals and these roads. They naively assume that they've got that same good spirit, that same creative will inside of themselves. They are blind to actually the dark, ugly reality that's often inside the slave. This blunt resentment, this pettiness, this lack of ambition, this negativity. They blind themselves to this. They naively overlook that. They don't look closely enough. And then this comes to punish them in the most horrible way you can imagine. The slaves, the victims, do not have that goodwill inside of themselves. Instead, they are quietly biding their time, maybe even unconsciously, deep down in their souls. They are biding their time for vengeance. They got traumatized by these masters. These masters are not their friends. These masters are evil and Sauron themselves. They don't want the masters to just feel guilty. That's not enough. The depth of the hate in a slave is never enough. You feeling guilty is no answer to me having thousands, millions of my people starved by my potato famines, by you stealing my spuds. Nothing makes up for that. Nothing except extreme amounts of violence. Nothing except total retribution. Nothing except me absolutely destroying everything that you have. The slave resents the master when it comes down to it. The slave wants an orgy of vengeance. They want to express all that trauma that has built up inside of them and has festered and turned into this toxic wound inside of them. And they remember. They remember for a long time. They allow themselves to wait as long as they want. And as Nietzsche said, always beware of the weak, because the patient weak person allows their hate to distort and morph into monstrous sizes inside of themselves. And so they wait and they wait and they wait. And then when the master is weak enough, when the Englishman shows up naively saying, oh, well, maybe we'll reorganize the way we do things and we'll all move towards this utopia of equality. And, you know, you potato famine Irish people, or you victims from across our colonial empires, you can all participate in our society. That's not what happens. Instead, their society gets pulled down. They get humiliated. The English get pushed out of all their institutions. Everything about them gets destroyed. Their guilt is exploited. It is not understood with a good sportsmanship that they're trying to, you know, lift somebody else up. Instead, the hand that is lifting them up is grabbed and they are pulled down and then they are stepped upon.
In Rome, you see the same pattern. You see all these slaves from across the empire demanding that the perspective of the slaves is raised up as to the redemptive religious perspective, the rising of the Romans acknowledging the perspective of those that they have enslaved in the past. And I guess many Romans probably thought that they're going to create this utopia. They're going to create this kingdom of equality. It's always that story where everybody is lifted up and everything is equal. But of course, that didn't happen. When the Christians began to get power, when that world perspective began to get installed, they began to destroy the pagan Roman temples. They began to ostracize them and push them out. They began to tear down the statues from within. They were burning the Library of Alexandria. They were, you know, stripping out priestesses and beating them to death in the street. Once they had enough power, they began to launch themselves and express that power. The vengeance began to show its ugly head. It started off as this pretty hope that, you know, the Romans would have a little bit of guilt and understand the victim's perspective. But once they had enough power, it all began to change. And you can see this in the fantasies of people like Tertullian. You can see these people talking about their idea of this redemptive orgy of violence in heaven, where, you know, all the Roman athletes and all the Roman poets and all the Roman statesmen would all be in the Colosseum getting eaten by lions. They would be the ones being tortured because it's vengeance. Vengeance is what they're looking for, and vengeance feels good. Vengeance is motivating. Vengeance is an expression of that will to power that the slave can't honestly say that he wants. And this is always the savage realization the master has right at the very, very end, the realization that they were naive and wrong. This happened in the French Revolution, where you had the royal families, the conquering people of France, who had organized this giant society and made it so abundant that there was just too many people in the society. And of course, all these extra people begin to say to themselves, well, look, we want representation. We want those high status positions that all you guys have. We want equality. We want equal representation. We want to be lifted up to your level. Why don't you let us lift up to your level? And of course, the power structure maybe permits it a little bit. They give these reforms and do these types of things, but it's never enough. And then it's not enough on time either. So eventually there's this big revolution that is thrown. And all of a sudden, they begin to show what they really are. The second the revolution happens and victory is achieved, the second the revolution is able to rip the royal families out of their houses and bring them to the guillotine, all of a sudden they understand what was truly going on here. It was vengeance. They wanted death. And this is the same momentum that is currently moving through the West. These old conquering races of Western Europe naively feel this guilt and believe that they need to recreate the society of equality and welcome all these victims in and allow them to reshape society according to their story and their urges, not realizing that the victims aren't on the same page as them. They don't want to create this beautiful utopia that was created in Western Europe over the last 300 or 400 years. Instead, they would be happily tear it down as long as they saw Sauron humiliated on the floor. They don't really care about that stuff. They're motivated by vengeance. They're motivated by retribution. They don't have that ascendant energy inside of themselves that they're trying to lift up. Instead, us hobbits, I'm one of them, we are beyond criticism. We don't have to introspect. We are assumed that we're just the righteous people just because we're the victims. We're given that perspective and that permission. And what you see in Nietzschean terms is that a slave morality has successfully instantiated itself as the morality that dominates the entire culture. The slave morality has been installed in the masters, and the slave morality makes the slaves innocent, makes the slaves, you know, the story never says that the slaves are bitter and resentful. That wouldn't be right. Instead, it is a story that is presented where the slaves are righteous and innocent, fighting the demons that are evil. And so this is a pretty brutal call out from Nietzsche. The will inside of us minorities, us Irish, us blacks, us Jews, us people who have been kept outside of the master races project of the French, of the English, of the Italians, of the Spanish. Our will is not really to build a future. We don't really think about a future too much. We don't really care about a future.
our discussion is not about, you know, building advanced technology or creating new organizational structures. All we really care about is enforcing our moral values onto the current regime. We want to see equality. We want to see fair representation. We want to see us in positions of power. We want to see things made more fair for us. We demand this. We have no vision really beyond that. We don't see on these far horizons. We're not thinking big. Our fantasies are about vengeance, not about traveling space or setting up new paradigms of human advancement. And all this is to say that, can us victims be trusted? Are our instincts really something that we should lay our hopes for the future on? If we get power over Western civilization, we're more likely to pull it down in a frenzy of vengeance and destroy it and end the project in its totality. But there's a caveat to this. Of course, there always is. Because in some sense, none of this stuff is objective. There's not really a good or evil in the way that we would like it to be. It doesn't mean the masters are necessarily good and that we should be fighting for them on instinct. There's no reason for us to say that we're allowed to try stop the fall of Western civilization. Why would that be? Western civilization rose at the expense of lots of other people. And if Western civilization and the master races who ran it aren't strong enough to hold that project up, why should we stop it? It's weak. It's falling. Rome fell. Rome rose up and then it got too big for its boots and then it collapsed. And that was at the expense of Rome, but that benefited many other people. The Germans took great advantage of that and ended up running up and creating Western civilization out of the ruins of Rome. Would it have been right for us to stop Rome from falling so that the Germans could achieve something like that? I'm not too sure. In fact, what right do we have to stop natural processes? Everything grows, everything rises, and everything dies. Rome had to die at some point. Western civilization's gonna have to fall at some point. It seems like now might be the time. Who are we to stop it? This fascinating question is best understood by looking at people like David Attenborough, these people who do nature documentaries, and they might be recording some poor little prey animal, this gazelle who has got lost from its tribe, this little baby, and it is wandering into lion territory. And every instinct inside of you would say to yourself, you know what, we should just get out of this helicopter or this jeep and fly down there and pick this gazelle up and send it back to where it comes from. But they can't do that because they can never help, because they have to let nature take its course, because there's this weird cascade of consequences for when you interact with these things. Of course, saving the gazelle might be fantastic. It might make you feel great. But that actually means that maybe some poor lion and some little baby lion cub are going to starve to death. That gazelle might have walked straight into the mother's way and then she would have been able to feed her kids. And who are you to say one life is better than the other? Or maybe that gazelle would have fallen down and its body would have decayed and died. And then all these bacteria and these worms could eat it instead of them starving in the desert or something like this. You don't get to decide what is right or wrong with these things. It's a very challenging question. You don't get to say that natural processes shouldn't happen. And when things die, they make space for new things to come into place. And so we see this in history. Rome was a magnificent civilization. It was profound beyond all comprehensible beliefs, but it got too big for its boots. It started to harvest in all these people from its colonies, and then this distorted it and destroyed it, and it lost the sense of itself, and it bloated into this giant bureaucratic monstrosity. And essentially it was like an old, cancerous, grey, tired body, and it imploded. And maybe we could have held it together. Maybe we could have fixed it. Maybe we could have saved it and made it live for another 400 or 500 years. But because Rome fell, it left space for a new power to rise. The power of these Germans coming in. And these Germans set up the Christian kings that set the 2,000 years that led to the West. The fall of something old was the beginning of something new. And in the perspective of these Romans, these tired, old master races, they were falling down. They were going through this cycle and this end. And they were moving from being the masters into actually becoming slaves. And then these Germans, who in many sense were slaves to these Romans at many points in their life, were now rising up to take this status of master. And maybe it was important that this happens because they were bringing a new lease of life, a new youthful, vital energy in their spirits that was leading us in a new direction. And so when you look around the West right now, and actually just as I was recording this video, some massive riots kicked off in France, for example, and you look at these things and you see what is happening is all these people who have been colonized in the past have been taken in under this guise of these liberal high ideals of these old master races like France, like the French. But the French are tired, and their ideals were the delusions that were built up at the peak of their power when they could enforce them. But they can no longer enforce them. They can no longer enforce their world vision, their empire, their free liberal paradigm. They can't do that anymore because they don't have the will. They don't have that vital force inside of themselves that is necessary. They're dying. They're falling. And there is nothing that they can do now to hold back these alternate perspectives, to hold back the resentment of those that they conquered in the past. And so this resentment is spiraling out of control. And this is a profound Buddhist meditation in a way. Everything comes apart. Weirdly, everything inside of you that keeps you alive right now are going to be the same things that destroy you. The slaves, the people from all these colonies that the French brought into themselves, were working within France up until the point where France becomes weak, and then they destroy them and eat them. And this is the same with you. When you die, you've got all these bacteria living inside your stomach. You've got all this bacteria living in your skin right now in this symbiosis. And you live perfectly functional because you're full of vitality and your immune system can project order and form onto your body. You can establish a reality and you can establish a perspective and a world, and you decide how your body is going to work. You run the body politic. But when you die, the second you die, that immune system stops. And that order is no longer formed. And so all this bacteria that lives in you right now and protects you and cleans your skin and helps you and keeps you running and keeps everything working for you, the second that immune system stops imposing order upon these little microorganisms, they will begin eating you from the inside out. The very things that live in your stomach will just completely swallow up your insides, chew up all your inner organs. All the skin in your face will just start to gnaw into the flesh and eat you alive. And all of a sudden, you'll be eaten by the things that were holding you together in the first place. And this is what we see happening in the West. It's the force of entropy. These forces cascading inwards and sucking the life and consuming the giant body that was created because the body has lost its will. Now, I understand this is very pessimistic. This is very bleak. But I'm trying to be realistic. I'm trying to take a trend perspective on reality. I'm trying to understand the cascade of all these symptoms and all these causes that are leading us into this era. You see an awful lot of this sort of emotional, reactionary talk, people trying to find a cause or reason for what is happening, without understanding that these have been forces that have been in play for hundreds of years. This is like dealing with gods. These things are so much bigger than us. Our tiny little lives are barely a fraction of it. These trends are 5 to 10 times older than me. What am I in the face of these things? This is like me being a little shrimp trying to fight a tidal wave. I have no power against this stuff. I'm barely conscious of this. The last maybe 3, 4, 5 years, I've started to understand these types of trends and how they are active. What can I do to stop them? What can any of us do to stop them? Instead, is it not smarter for us to understand them and take a slightly different approach? And this is where we find use in one of Nietzsche's most genius perspectives. You see, when he made his critique of morality, he was specifically learning to see this relative way that morality works depending on your perspective in your stories. He understood this very profound idea that if you are a victim, you're going to create a world story that is going to pit a Sauron who is evil, and you're going to be pitted as a hobbit who is good. And it doesn't matter if you're Irish, or if you're Jewish, or if you're an African-American slave, or an Indian. Your experience is fighting this monumental tyrannical force like the English or the European colonizer, and you're going to have a world perspective. And there's a morality built into that, and you're going to enforce that morality on the world like it's a religion. It actually is a religion for you because it's going to be emotionally charged with your existential fears of you getting killed or getting conquered or dying. It's going to be very emotional for you. And this world perspective is not the same as other world perspectives. You can have people who are conquerors, who have a different story playing out, a different sense of good and evil, an entirely different conception of the story in and of itself. They would see themselves not as Sauron. They would not see the people they conquer as evil tyrants. They would instead see them as, you know, these incompetent wretches who can't get themselves organized. We would call them bad or poor, as we said. And understanding this relativity of morality really opens your eyes to the profoundness of our situation. Because we have been born into a regime, a spiritual paradigm that educates us fully on that victim perspective. And that's the loser's perspective. And you can see that this is a part of a declining, falling culture. It's the part of a weak culture. And what Nietzsche is pointing out is that those morals are not absolute. They don't have to be absolute. They're not objective. They're just relative to the way that you want to look at reality. But you don't have to look at reality that way. You can take a different perspective. You can take a winner's perspective. You can approach the world in that master perspective. And you could actually be the beginning of something new, something ascending, something rising. You could be the Germans at the end of Rome. You don't have to be the Romans, and you don't have to be the conquered slaves living within Rome, because both of those are miserable people, believe me. If you're the Romans living within Rome, you're sitting there with your head in your hands, pining about the old way. You see all your people infected with this new victim perspective, this victim morality. All your people shackled with this guilt about how horrible they were to conquer and colonize the whole world and crucify all those poor slaves. Those people who are depressed and weak. They've lost their vitality. You will see an awful lot of that in the West right now, but that's not an absolute way that you have to see reality. Or maybe you were a slave, a historical slave trapped within that empire, and you have this victim psychosis, and you're possessed by this furious resentment, and you can't see beyond this, and you have no higher consciousness of the future, and you don't believe in anything great. Instead, you just have a will to destroy inside of yourself. You're just resentful and angry and aggressive, and you can't let it go, and you can't build anything. And you're stuck in this dialectic, fighting between the masters and the slave with no end in sight. This spiral of violence and nonsense and insanity. And it's going to lead to a destruction. It's a body that has gotten weak, and all its inner parts now are fighting with each other. But in Rome, the Germans from outside of Rome, the Goths coming from the north, who climbed out of their forest, they had a natural perspective on the world. They were engaged with life, they were healthy, they were full of vitality, and they were strong. And so when they charged down into Rome, they were bringing with them that honest, emergent, rising force. They had that healthy attitude of their right to take over the world and establish their culture and establish their forms. And this is why they built Western civilization, because they believed in themselves on a fundamental level. They had the fire in their souls where they believed in creating the future. They had a master's perspective, a conqueror's perspective, and most importantly, they had the creative will to life fully expressing inside of themselves. And they charged into Rome and they took control of the thing that was falling. And they were only small teams of people. They weren't some massive, overbloated population. They were small groups of people who were vitally in the right place. Their heads were straight. And they're slandered as barbarians in history, but these people set up the infrastructure that led to the highest civilization that has ever existed on Earth. And we may be living through either a crisis in our one, or maybe even the total implosion and collapse. And the answer that you see in Nietzsche is that if you have the spiritual creativity and strength to pause, to step back, to separate from your racial perspective, either if it's a victim perspective like me as an Irishman, or maybe it's a guilt-ridden master perspective like an Englishman or something like this, you have the opportunity to step back from that, to understand that these moral pillars, these, you know, grand, decorate moral absolutes that people dangle in front of you, these perspectives, these world stories that people try to shove into your mind all the time, you don't necessarily have to accept them. You can step outside of it and say to yourself, how do I participate and create a culture of vitality and health? How do I reach towards the future? How do I be a part of the force that is the ascending, emerging, new, youthful force that is going towards the future, instead of these falling forces of resentment and guilt that are pulling themselves down into the gravity of life? How do I make sure that I'm an ascendant force? That's what you're looking for, especially in times of decline. That ascendant force is the future, is hope, is potential, is the ability to create something that has a destiny. And as Nietzsche pointed out, it is in those people who can grab this reality, break free from all the shackles shackles of world stories, victim perspectives, guilt, break free from all these negative psychological places and align themselves with their own creative impulse, overcome the poison of modernity that makes them depressed and holds them down, and launch themselves onto an ascendant path to create a culture and a team and a network of people that can go towards the sky. Those people have the potential to do incredible things, just like those Germans who took over Rome as it was falling, went on to become the aristocrats of 2,000 years over Europe. We're going to see the people who are able to ascend out of this cascade, out of this symphony of destruction and decline, out of this guilt psychosis and resentment frenzy, the people who can lift up out of this and overcome this circumstance, they are going to lead towards a type of man that has never before been seen on Earth. They're going to harvest the powers of such a modern world, a modern civilization, and be able to transform themselves potentially into something of a new level, all the way beyond man, all the way into a culture so profound, so big, so beyond the next level that we might call them an overman. We might say that this is the stairs that leads all the way to the Übermensch.